Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, your Friday morning Utah news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, and heard all over the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, a mineral company applies to lengthen canals on the Great Salt Lake, worrying environmentalists. Utah Democrats sue to force Joel Ferry, a now former state representative, off of the November ballot. New leadership at the Utah Inland Port Authority hits pause on big-ticket spending. And a Tribune columnist says that it's right and proper for a president to call out fascism. Joining me for this conversation on the Zoom, we have got Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Good morning, Leah. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Roger. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And on the Zoom as well, we've got Tribune news columnist George Pyle, an editorial page editor as well. Thanks for being here, George.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And in just a little bit, we will hear from political correspondent Brian Schott as well, so stay tuned for that. Listeners, you can join this conversation with your questions and comments by tweeting them to us. Our handle is at KCPW. We are unable to take calls today. Well, we've been hearing a lot about the plight of the Great Salt Lake, which we know is imperiled, especially by water diversion upstream. But there are compounding issues, compounding worries for the lake, including concerns about just how salty it is getting as the lake level shrinks down. This week, Leah Larson, you reported on a request by a major industrial operator out on the lake to expand some of its canals. What is this proposal all about?
Yeah, so U.S. Magnesium, which operates on the south end of the lake over in Tooele County, they are having a hard time reaching the water, so they can't use their intake canals to fill up their evaporation ponds and extract the minerals they need. And they also use those intake canals to send brine to other companies operating down there. There's like another salt plant. And then also the brine shrimp operators, I guess, use those canals to launch their boats and go harvest the cysts, which they're going to have to start doing here in about a month. So they were concerned about that. And what they told me is it was a couple of years ago, they went to the Army Corps of Engineers in search of permission to dredge the lake bed and make those canals longer. And the Army Corps just started reviewing that application. And yeah, like you said, some environmentalists are alarmed.
Yeah, just quickly. So the idea here, I want to just verify that I understand it. Like they're not getting enough water to do the work that they do and to share the water, I guess, with the people who they have traditionally done that with. And so what U.S. Magnesium does is they bring in water and then they sort of spread it out and evaporate the water. That is how they extract the magnesium from the water, from the brine, that is. Is the idea here to dredge to where the deeper water is, further into the lake to get more water into those canals, basically carving a longer canyon to get to the water that has now receded further away from them?
Yeah, if you think about the Great Salt Lake, it's kind of just like a really big puddle. It's not very deep. So when we lose like a few feet or, fractions of a foot of water, it actually, the water recedes quite a bit. So they have to extend some of it, like one of their canals by a couple of miles. Yeah, so you got it exactly right. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get back to the water's edge to ensure that they have enough water flowing in that they can stay in business.
There's a few questions that I want to keep asking. So how low is the lake right now? Meaning we know earlier this summer at its historic all-time low, which surpassed a previous historic all-time low the year before. Where is it in comparison to that right now, Leah?
Yeah, I should have looked up the elevation this morning. I feel bad I didn't. But it hit a record low in July, and it's been very hot since then, and heat means the water keeps evaporating. So it's gone down bit by bit, day by day. So it probably will keep receding through October, maybe to November, depending on what the weather does and the climate does.
And then in terms of mineral extraction and these canals and the amount of water that it uses, how much water does it take for companies like U.S. Magnesium to do the work they do?
That's a really good question. And they do use a lot of water. I mean, if you think about the Salt Lake, like it's very salty, but it's still mostly water. So they've got to concentrate that brine to get the minerals they need, whether it's salt, whether it's magnesium, whether it's, some of them are doing lithium now. Yeah. Oh, sorry, I forgot your original question. Can you repeat
just,
it?
Just how much if we have a sense of like the extent of the water.
Yeah, they do use quite a bit. But interestingly, when the lake gets low like this and it's the salinity goes up, they use less and less because it's, you know, nature kind of already did the concentrating for them in a lot of regards. But they do use a lot of water. Like it ranges from, I think they said a maximum of like 130,000 acre feet they use. And I know that's hard to wrap your head around, but that's, you know, quite a bit more than even the city of Salt Lake uses to, I think this year it was like around 40,000 acre feet, which was, it was around, you know, it's a fraction of what Salt Lake City uses, but still quite a lot of water.
Yeah, of course. And then the other thing I guess to think about there is that it's not water. Well, actually, I'm not even going to say what I was going to say. I mean, the water is so briny that, or so salty out there that, you know, it's not water that people could use. But of course, it serves a function, as we know, on the ecosystem and helps protect our lungs, for example, from the dried up lake bed. Okay, and as you said, they use less water as the lake level falls because the minerals are concentrated in there. Isn't this just, sorry, I'm curious about the operations of the mineral operators out there. And U.S. Magnesium, am I right that it's the only place in the United States that produces magnesium at all?
I think there's a few companies like out in Nevada that are experimenting with it. But yes, as of right now, it's the only, you know, commercial producer of magnesium, and as such, it, you know, is very protective of its trade secrets.
Got it. Okay, so you mentioned the fact that it was concerning to environmentalists, the idea that they're dredging out these longer canyons to get to the puddle. Comments submitted to the Army Corps of Engineers by the group Friends of Great Salt Lake on this proposal, they have concerns. What do they say?
Yeah, so by extending the canals, it follows that U.S. Magnesium will be able to take more water, and Friends of Great Salt Lake says that's exactly what the lake doesn't need right now. It needs all the water it can get to stay in the lake, and so I think that is their primary concern. We shouldn't be encouraging or supporting anybody seeking to take water out of the lake right now.
Okay, and I mean, has the U.S. Corps of the Army Corps of Engineers, have they said, you know, anything about the timeline and whether or not they're weighing those kinds of comments when it comes to approving this? And this proposal is a couple of years old, right? Or a few years old, in fact.
That's what U.S. Magnesium told me. There's no information on the Army Corps that I could find that indicates when they actually did submit their permit application. And I did send a list of questions to the Army Corps of Engineer guy that's kind of building all the comments and supervising the application. And I have yet to hear back from him, but when I do, I will file an update story.
I mean, magnesium, the operator, U.S. Magnesium, says that they are concerned about the fate of the lake because their fortunes are tied to it. You mentioned the idea that they, or maybe actually, no, excuse me, it's Friends of Great Salt Lake in their comments mentions the idea, the potential possibility or scheme. Boy, I'm having a hard time finding the right phrasing for this, but the idea that U.S. Magnesium could conceivably donate water rights to the lake because they hold pretty substantial water rights on the lake, right?
They do, yes. They do hold pretty substantial water rights.
What would that do, or how would the donation work, I guess?
It's a great question. So, I mean, in the past, until this year, actually, that wouldn't have even been possible. But the legislature passed a bill this past session that does allow companies, farmers, pretty much anybody with a water right to at least lease it to the state. So they could lease their water right to the state, and the state could take that water and put it to environmental use, whether that's to improve in stream flows or whether to raise the level of the Great Salt Lake. So it is an idea in theory that they could do. However, when I spoke to U.S. Magnesium, they kind of scoffed at that idea because it's not exactly easy to buy a water right now. And they're not even using their full water right. So they couldn't even, you know, give at least their water right to the state in theory, because they're not even fully using it, if that makes sense. So that was their argument. And you know, you did mention that the U.S. Magnesium's fortunes kind of depend on getting water out of the lake. But I think what's interesting too is there's this weird balancing act that we have to strike, because the mineral companies pay royalties to the state. And just this year, the legislature again made sure that those royalties that are collected from mineral harvesting operations on the Great Salt Lake are reinvested back into the Great Salt Lake. So that's one big major funding mechanism we need to restore the lake's health and hopefully keep it from collapsing. So it's kind of this weird balancing act, like I said, like where do we get that revenue if these companies collapse? And
can I ask,
it's very complicated all around.
Sure. No, and I mean, obviously we know it is, and a lot of focus, this reporting, we should say, was done in conjunction with the Great Salt Lake Collaborative, which the Salt Lake Tribune belongs to, and so does KCPW. But I wanted to ask about the Friends of Great Salt Lake's argument that, you know, we're waiting, the lake is supposedly going to be getting more water from these mechanisms that have been set up in you know, recent legislative sessions, and because of a heightened focus on the lake. And the argument they're making is that, to the Army Corps of Engineers, is that by, you know, you're basically just sucking that new water out just as it's coming in. Did U.S. Magnesium respond to that that assertion by Friends of Great Salt Lake?
Yeah, they did. You know, I think their position is that everybody's cutting back right now. Farmers are cutting back, cities are cutting back, and they are cutting back too. They're aware of the lake's condition. They want a healthy lake because if, you know, the lake collapses, that affects their business. So they're doing everything they can. They're not making a killing on extracting minerals from the lake, but they want to stay in business just like any business that, you know, needs water, or any, you know, farming operation that needs water. I would say that that's their position.
Okay. And then again, supposedly, you know, as I said, more water is supposed to be making its way to the lake because of these new structures in place. Is that happening yet?
Hard to get an answer on that. I have asked the governor, I've asked some of the environmental groups that are charged with, you know, building these relationships and forging these deals, and they're kind of tight-lipped about it so far. That is something I'm hoping to follow up on by the end of the water year, which ends in October, and we'll see.
Okay, and then just you brought up lithium. I don't want to leave it just kind of hanging there. This lithium's a hot commodity right now, and MagCorp, U.S. Magnesium, they are pursuing they're pursuing extracting magnesium, let's put it that way, as is a group in the north of the lake, Compass Minerals. Is that a water-intensive process?
Ah, such a good question. Actually, no, because U.S. Magnesium is extracting the lithium from their waste piles, like from all those salt piles that they, you know, pulled their magnesium from and other materials. So they kind of dump them on their properties. So they're going back through all those decades and decades of extracted material, and that's where they're getting their lithium. However, Compass Minerals, I'm not quite sure, they're kind of, you know, mum on what their process is or whether they're even extracting lithium right now. So I'm not sure if it would be water intensive for them. I guess we'll see.
I think you mentioned in your article, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that Compass Minerals also is hoping to dredge its canals further or something like that.
Yeah, the state division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands, which manages the lake bed and all the leases that the mineral companies have to operate on the lake bed, they did confirm that Compass Minerals had expressed interest in also extending their intake canals.
Okay. And then, so just in terms of what the Army Corps is doing with the request from not Compass Minerals, but from U.S. Magnesium, do we have a time frame on when they might say, yep, you can do it, or further review is required?
No, we don't know what the timeline is. I know that U.S. Magnesium is hoping for, you know, an expedited response, but I think we all know that the federal government kind of moves at its own pace, so we'll see.
Okay. You know, I want to talk a little bit more about the lake, particularly a piece of activism that you went out there and covered, and actually some other related stories, but I want to bring George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist, into the conversation. And George, as with everything, there's this, Leah kind of brought up the circle of consequences. The lake goes down, industry suffers, there's royalties that help pay for conservation efforts out on the lake. But then, you know, as industry suffers, they dredge, and maybe as a result, conceivably, the lake goes down and so on. Maybe that's not the most accurate take, I'm not certain, but it seems kind of like the case. What do you think about all of this, George Pyle? What's your how do you feel about the fact that there are requests to keep doing what we're doing on the lake.
Well, what we're seeing is the reason why the Utah political class more than ever has kind of woken up and realized that there's a problem with the shrinking of the Great Salt Lake. At first, you would think that our Republican legislators would say, well, it's just about birds and it's just about sea monkeys and it's just a big old smelly marsh and who cares? And they're starting to realize why everybody should care. In addition to the dry lake bed blowing off toxic materials into Salt Lake City, you have the businesses like U.S. Magnesium, and so more people are becoming aware that the Great Salt Lake, as it has been, is not just a tourist attraction and not just a stopover for migrating birds. It's a revenue source for the state and for the businesses that pay the royalties to the state, like U.S. Magnesium. But they're they're stuck now because they're not getting enough water from their existing infrastructure. They want to build longer and deeper canals to get to that water. If they do that, they will use up what water is in the lake faster and hasten the day where they can't function anymore, not just because their canal is too short or too shallow, but because there's no water there at all. So that's where you have to have a state and activist groups come in who have a long horizon to look at this kind of thing. And instead of U.S. Magnesium just, and this is the way businesses have to think, trying to get all the money they can out of the lake before it dies, you need to have the state and the activist groups thinking, how about if the lake doesn't die? How about if we do some things to slow that down? That's why it was proposed that maybe it would be in U.S. Magnesium's interest to find a way to get more water coming into the lake, acquire some water rights upstream, have more water come into the lake so that them taking water out of the lake is something that wouldn't be as damaging and could last longer. For all the criticism I have of the Utah legislature and our administrations, they have taken some steps that not every state has taken, that has not been the way water policy has worked for hundreds of years, which is they have done away with the use it or lose it attitude toward water rights. They have passed pretty remarkable legislation to allow farmers and other water rights holders to forego use, to lease it, to sell it, and to consider keeping the rivers flowing and the lake filling a useful use of water, instead of the only useful kind of, the only thing of with water that was considered actually useful was either agriculture or industry. Now just filling the lake and filling the streams is seen as a constructive use of water.
Yeah, and I think we're going to wait on. I mean, I want to get Leah. Will continue. I know to report on that, and we asked her the question directly, like how much water is actually getting out there as a result of these efforts. And as of yet, we're not certain. Although the mechanisms appear to be coming online, and there's a fund that will pay for water rights transfers and so on and so forth. George, I'm going to mute you and bring Leah Larson back into the conversation because Leah, George mentioned the long view of activists versus a sort of shorter term view based on profits. A theatrical action out on the lake that you reported on that I want to kind of turn to now to draw attention to what's happening out there. This is a so-called die-in at the Great Salt Lake. What was this all about? What happened?
Yeah, so if you remember back in 2017, 2018, there was a group of high school students who organized and kind of lobbied the legislature to recognize climate change and acknowledge the existential threat that it presented to the state. And to their credit, they did. Our very conservative legislature passed a bill recognizing climate change back then. So they wanted to take that momentum and just, keep educating students, I guess, about climate change and the environment around them. And they kind of lost steam during the pandemic, like I think a lot of us did, but regrouped this year. And a lot of those students that pushed, lobbied the legislature now in college, and they're trying to pass the torch to these high school students. So a group of them did a kind of symposium I guess, over the summer, learning about the environment, climate change, and they camped out overnight on Antelope Island. And, you know, if you go out there, for me, it doesn't matter how often I go out there, it's just so stark to see all that exposed lake bed and those declining water levels. And, you know, it's just kind of scary. And so I think that had a profound impact on them. They wanted to organize an event. So Saturday, they organized what they called a die-in for the Great Salt Lake, where they went out to the lake bed by the Saltaire and called on their elected leaders to do more to help the lake. Because, you know, a lot of the burden of its fallout, the toxic dust, the warming temperatures, you know, they're going to bear a lot of the brunt of that as they grow older.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some really interesting photos and video actually that accompanies your story that I will direct people to. Really interesting action, and yeah, I mean, these are high school kids. These are kids in their mid-teens who are doing this, right?
Yeah, high school age, and there were some college students that had been involved with that initial lobbying effort with the legislature.
Okay. Just finally on the lake before we head to a break here, Leah, I want to turn, there's one more thing that I'd like to ask you about, which is a topic from, or a story from last week that you covered, which was a warning to people to stay off the dry lake bed. And this was in the wake of a unique astronomical event. We had a meteor come through Utah, and there were apparently meteor hunters going out and even, sort of having an impact on the dry lake bed, which is kind of dangerous. Can you tell us about that warning?
Yeah, so I think the state has been trying to educate the public for a while since the lake started receding about staying off the lake bed, especially don't drive on it. I think some people with ATVs are a little curious, you know, like what's going on all those islands now that I can drive out to them, but actually they're like important nesting sites for birds.
Yeah.
So when that meteor boomed across the sky about a month ago and got everybody's attention, all these meteor hunters descended on Utah to go find pieces of space rock out in the desert. And the Salt Lake Tribune did a story about a guy who found one, and we were pretty vague about where it was, but we did mention it was, you know, west of the waters of the Great Salt Lake. So I guess that increased traffic on the lake bed. And really, you really should not be driving on the lake bed because it breaks up the salt crust that's keeping the dust down for now. And we really want to protect that salt crust so we're not breathing in lake bed dust.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, just a good reminder of what you should and shouldn't be doing. And thanks for that as well, Leah. I will direct people, you know, there's a lot of great reporting by Leah Larson on this at the Salt Lake Tribune's website. It's published much of it through the Great Salt Lake Collaborative, which is a solutions journalism initiative that partners news, education, and media organizations and aims to inform readers about the plight of the Great Salt Lake. Leah Larson, I will just say thank you for this reporting. There's more to come from Leah in the show. We're going to take a quick break at the moment, though. And when we come back, we will turn to political correspondent Brian Schott and a move by Utah Democrats to get Joel Ferry, who is head of the Utah Division of Natural Resources, but also now a former state lawmaker, to get him off of the November ballot. Brian will explain. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCBW and Utah Public Radio. We're going to take a quick break, back in just a minute.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson and by editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle. This is our live Friday morning Utah News wrap-up. You can join us with your questions and comments by tweeting them to @KCPW. Well, Joel Ferry resigned from the state legislature last month after being appointed to lead the Utah Division of Natural Resources. But the Republican Party neglected to replace him on the ballot for his old seat. He faced an election this year. Utah Democrats say that he is legally forbidden from being on the ballot while he's the head of the DNR. Tribune political correspondent Brian Schott wrote this story, and I recorded our conversation on Thursday. Brian Schott, thanks so much for making time for this. Really appreciate it.
Sure.
So the Utah Democratic Party is, or Democrats are trying to get Joel Ferry off the ballot. And maybe you can just kind of give us the background on this. Like, why is there a fight over whether or not Representative Joel Ferry might be headed towards re-election?
Well, Joel Ferry back in June was tapped by Governor Spencer Cox to become the new head of the Department of Natural Resources. That, as people said, created a constitutional conflict because he's a member of the governor's cabinet, but also held a spot in the legislature, which the Constitution says you cannot do. They tried to get around that by claiming that Ferry was only taking the salary from his job at the Department of Natural Resources and was foregoing his legislative salary, which, you know, seems like sort of a weasel way around it, and nobody was buying it. Ferry did not resign. He finally resigned late last month after a Senate committee held a confirmation hearing for his job. And he went through, he will either be confirmed either sometime this month or next month. The Senate has, I think, 60 days now to act on that, on his appointment. Even though he has resigned, Ferry is remaining on the ballot in HD 1, and here's the reason why. He got the nomination for the party back in April, and the deadline passed for the party to replace him on the ballot. The only way that you can replace someone on the ballot under Utah law is if they die, if they have a debilitating mental or physical illness that would prevent them from running, or if they resign to run for president or vice president. That's it. You cannot replace a candidate on the ballot for any other reason. So he was remaining on the ballot. That makes sense because this is a district that the Republicans have won with over 70% of the vote in each of the last five elections. It is a solidly Republican district in mostly Box Elder County. So Ferry was remaining on the ballot. Democrats said he can't remain on the ballot because he can't take office. And the game here is that Ferry would remain on the ballot, he would most likely win, and that would allow not the voters, but Republican delegates to pick the person who's going to fill that seat for the next 2 years. They asked the lieutenant governor to kick him off the ballot. Lieutenant governor said, there's no reason, there's nothing under Utah law to kick him off the ballot. So on Wednesday, they filed a lawsuit in federal court claiming that Ferry was violating the Hatch Act, which is a law that says you cannot run for partisan political office if you oversee a program that is funded with federal funds. As the head of DNR, he fits the bill. And Utah has a law in the books that says the state must follow the federal law. It's called the Little Hatch Act. So we follow that law. It's pretty clear that he cannot run for office. At least their argument seems to have a lot of merit, that he cannot run for a partisan political office while the head of the Department of Natural Resources.
It's an argument that has worked before, correct? Meaning that people have been forced off the ballot or have at least resigned when, you know, violations of the Hatch Act, potential violations of the Hatch Act have been drawn to light before, correct?
Yep. Back in 2006, John Greiner, who was the police chief in Ogden, won election to the state Senate. In 2010, when he ran for re-election, the Democrats said he can't do that. It's a violation of the Hatch Act. They went to court. An administrative judge says, yeah, you're violating the Hatch Act. So he dropped his re-election bid. Later, a federal panel ordered Ogden to fire him as police chief or lose federal funds because he was violating the Hatch Act, and Congress just thought that they were going to make some changes to it, but they never really did. So Ferry's in a little bit of a pickle here.
What happens if he gets kicked off the ballot? I mean,
if he gets kicked off the ballot, the only person on the ballot will be Democrat Joshua Hardy. You know, this is an 80% Republican district. Hardy's wife ran in 2020 and got creamed by Joel Ferry. You know, Hardy himself ran before. He got creamed by Joel Ferry. But if you only got one person who's on the printed ballot, you got a pretty good chance of winning a seat. There are three Republicans who have filed as write-in candidates ahead of the deadline, including former legislator Ben Ferry, Joel's uncle, who served in the legislature from 1999 until 2010. So you have three write-in candidates. They could split the vote. This is an absolute mess. At the same time, okay, Ferry resigned at the end of August. The Republican Party is now holding an election to pick his replacement to fill out the final 3 months of his term. They'll vote in Brigham City on the 20th. So you're going to have someone come in who, and I'm sure that all three of the write-in candidates have declared in that race that they have to win the vote of Republican delegates who will pick the a replacement for Ferry. And that person can only be there for 3 months. Ferry might get kicked off the ballot. This is an absolute mess right now.
Wild.
And the thing that's looming over all of it is a time deadline.
Yeah.
They have to get the ballots printed. Ballots have got to be printed, sent to the printer in a final form sometime next week. So they'll get them back in time so they can get them in the mail to people who live overseas and members of the military. And those have to be in the mail by like September 23rd. So this is looming over the whole thing.
Will the court take that into consideration? I mean, is the court going to act that quickly or be able to?
Well, the first thing they're asking for is an injunction to stop the printing of any ballots. Wow. So they can do this.
Brian, I know you got to go here in a second. I was wondering if you might quickly give us the sort of scoop on what's happening with Steve Handy, who is trying, speaking of writing campaigns, he's trying to win a seat in the legislature. How uncommon is it to win as a write-in candidate?
Well, I dived into the research, and there's only been one person who's ever done it before, and that was Charles Bullen, Chick Bullen, back in 1970. He ousted a former Speaker of the House who had lost his election to retain his job as Speaker of the House, and everyone thought he was too rude to the new Speaker. So up in Cache Valley, Republicans and Democrats banded together to petition Bullen on the ballot, and he ended up winning. So it doesn't happen that often. It is interesting because if it's going to happen, this is a very good, at least Handy has as good a chance as anybody that I can remember. He's got money. He's raised over $50,000 at this point for this race. He's got name ID. I mean, most people don't know who their legislators are, but those who do, you know, he's got name ID. People are used to voting for him. There is kind of a little sneaky thing that happened in this right before the deadline. A person also filed as a write-in candidate whose first name is Steve. Now that could gum up the works a little bit because Utah is a voter intent state. Now I'm not saying there's anything nefarious happening here, but when you do a write-in candidate, election judges have to do everything that they can to determine the intent of the voter. If you have two people named Steve in the race and the only name they can make out on the ballot is Steve, well, that ballot's not going to count.
Okay. And nefarious or not, it's interesting. Can you remind us why Stephen Handy did not make it on, you know, through a primary?
Well, he didn't even go to primary. He was ousted at the convention. He was ousted at the Davis County convention. And if you look at the numbers, there were like 92 people who voted in that race. And if you break it down, his opponent, Trevor Lee, who is the Republican nominee in the race, he got 53 votes in that race to win the nomination outright at the convention. Those 53 people represent 0.003% of the 18,000 voters in the district and 0.005% of all the Republicans in the district.
Could he have gone the signature route? Did he just not gather signatures?
Nope, he didn't try to do it. He missed the deadline for filing for signatures. It was severe political malpractice, and I think that it got a lot of people. Look at that result. Look at what happened to Steve Handy, and I can guarantee you that nobody is going to forego going the signature route ever again, especially if you're an incumbent who wants to get re-election.
Brian Schott is political correspondent with Salt Lake Tribune, has taken the time out of his day, busy day, to talk to us today. Thanks for doing it, Brian.
All right, thanks.
All right, and again, that is Brian Schott, political correspondent, and we ended up there talking about the write-in candidacy of Representative Stephen Handy, who was ousted in convention by a challenger from pretty far to the right. George Pyle, we can talk about that, but I'd actually like to go, George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist with the Tribune, I'd like to go back to the previous story that Brian and I discussed, which is the Democrats trying to get Joel Ferry off of the ballot. The Republicans would rather that he stay on and win because then they could just appoint someone of their liking, to his seat, which is, you know, generally considered a very safe Republican seat at the state legislature. Democrats are saying, you know, their argument is that it's not legal for him to even be on the ballot. Do you want to talk about that, George?
Well, it just goes to show how Republicans in Utah basically don't believe in democracy. They do everything they can to see to it that decisions are made by as small a group as possible. In both of these legislative races, we're talking about a handful of delegates deciding who the nominee will be, especially if the signature route is not used, as it was in that one district. And they're very open about the fact, one, that they don't care that it's against state and federal law and the Utah Constitution for somebody to be a member of the legislature and be an executive branch official at the same time. It's triple illegal. Spencer Cox and the Republicans did not care. They tried to put all these goofy things. Well, he's not taking his salary. Well, he's not sitting on certain committees. The Constitution doesn't say that. It says you can't be in both camps at once. It's integral to the American idea of the separation of powers. It's the similar provision is in the federal Constitution.
Right.
And the founders went out of their way to make sure that if you stand in one camp or the other. Of course, that's back when the founders, bless their hearts, thought that each branch of the federal government would be jealous of its own prerogatives and therefore keep the balance of power. They didn't foresee, or well, I think in some cases they did foresee and feared, the idea that parties would become more important than branch of government. And that's what we're seeing now at the federal level, where instead of Congress being jealous of its prerogatives and its duties, so many Republicans in Congress are eager to pronounce their loyalty to Donald Trump, again, just doing away with the separation of powers. I mean, the death of Queen Elizabeth, we've all been watching Parliament and Britain. In Britain, they don't have a separation of powers. They've got legislative, executive, and judicial all crammed into the Palace of Westminster, and they make it work. But it's not the American system.
Yeah. Yeah, George. I mean, what if Representative Ferry just made different hats? One that said I'm a representative today, and a hat that said I'm a head of the DNR today. I'm kidding.
Yeah, he puts on a blue cap or a red cap.
Yeah.
You pay attention to which. It's just flat illegal.
Quickly,
and
just
they
yeah. On the other story that we talked about, Stephen Handy, again, not gathering signatures and now trying to win as a write-in candidate means people have to physically write his name in if they want to see him elected. No stickers or anything are allowed. A cautionary tale, as Brian would have it, on the need for signature gathering and I guess obviously on what the caucus convention system gives us within the Republican Party here in Utah, at least.
Well, the caucus convention system is based on the idea that very important decisions like this need to be made by a very few people who have, and the argument correctly states that these people devote a lot of time and energy. They spend time meeting the candidates. They spend time talking to one another. They spend time researching the issues. And you know, there's some truth to that, but it isn't very democratic. It is based on the idea that we're smarter than you and we're devoted and we get to make this decision and what the rest of the district, even other registered Republicans think, doesn't matter. And it's not very democratic. We have now the workaround with the signatures. As Brian says, it really is political malpractice not to keep that signature route. But there are still a few areas where I think a politician will go to convention. And the fact that he hasn't collected signatures, she hopes, will endear him to the delegates by saying, I am putting all of my faith in you, the delegates. I am counting on you to send me through to the primary or the general. But even pledging that trust doesn't always work.
Well, and the winning candidate from convention, Trevor Lee, a challenge from way to the right from Representative Handy, and we will see what happens in District 1. George, just maybe I'll remind listeners that you're tuned to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Join this conversation by tweeting to us at KCPW is our handle, at KCPW. We're in the realm of politics, and so, George, maybe just let's stay in this vein for a second. You wrote about the hubbub in a column of yours, the apparent anger from some quarters over a statement, or sorry, a speech, that is, by President Joe Biden, in which he qualified the MAGA arm of the Republican Party as a threat to the American system, to American democracy. And your premise in your column is that this is entirely warranted. This is what a president should be doing, right?
Yes. I mean, there is no question but that he's telling the absolute truth here, that there is a hopefully small but very vocal, very powerful wing of the Republican Party that is against democracy, that is fascist in its nature, that and defined by loyalty to a leader, a nostalgia for a glorified past that probably never really existed, a definition of a country as blood and soil and not an idea, that only in our case that white male pseudo-Christians are allowed to rule, and that if a democratic election goes the other way, then that democratic election is flawed and needs to be shoved aside. We have people running for governor, not in Utah, but people running for governor, people running for attorney general, people running for secretary of state, which in other states is the official who runs elections, openly on a platform that the 2020 election was stolen, that Donald Trump is the rightful president, that all kinds of just baseless, groundless conspiracy theories about how the election was stolen, you know, basically openly pledging to fix elections to make sure that fascists win future elections. And in every election ever held in the history of mankind, in every country, there is always the danger that the next election will be the last election. If you don't elect people who believe in elections, who believe in democracy, who believe in respecting the will of the people. There are people openly running for office who don't believe that and will change that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you write that both Senator Mike Lee, someone who has been a staunch supporter of Trump and Trumpism, and Representative John Curtis, maybe surprising, more surprisingly, that they both called the speech by President Biden divisive. Their statement says that it drives the wedge deeper in society, and you say, nope. I mean, yeah, just explain that to us.
Good. I mean, we need to know who the fascists are. We need to know who the people, and particularly the candidates for public office, we need to know which one of them are fascists. Now, the president, when he was talking about first, before his big speech in Philadelphia, he talked about semi-fascists, and there are those of us who think that he was being too kind by saying semi. And then his speech in Philadelphia, he was attacking fascism. If you are not a fascist, he was not attacking you. If you feel attacked by the speech he made, to paraphrase a comedian, you might be a fascist. And I think maybe it's time to stop and look at what you think. Not everybody who voted for Donald Trump is a fascist. They voted for him for different reasons, for, you know, an in-your-face to the establishment, to the coastal establishment, to a government and an establishment that wasn't hearing their needs, that wasn't listening to people who feel like the world is passing them by. So there's always that. But now that we realize who these people are, the fact that they actually have a chance of winning some state elections, the fact that some polls show them perhaps taking back the U.S. House of Representatives, this is frightening, and people need to call it out. And it's the duty of the President of the United States, whoever he or she is, Democrat or Republican, to point this out and call our attention to it.
All right. George, there's more I'd love to go into with you on that, but I just in the interest of time, I will say that that is editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle. The headline of his column on this is "Somebody Needs to Call Out the Fascism, Including in Utah." It can be found over at sltrib.com. We're going to take another quick break here in the show and return with our underplayed stories of the week, probably. Maybe we'll try and squeeze in a little bit of more reporting from Leah Larson, depending on time. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Leah Larson and George Pyle. It's our Friday morning local news roundup. And Leah Larson, I do want to try and just quickly squeeze in a story that we've been following for years together now, both of us on this program. The Inland Port, your latest stories are about leadership changes at the port and about a kind of pause on new spending that seems significant to me. What's happening at the port? Maybe just give us a kind of rundown update, if you don't mind, Leah.
Yeah, it's good that you're squeezing it in because there's not a ton to say. But basically, the executive director, Jack Hedge, who was the first hire of the Inland Port Authority, who kind of built up the staff and drafted their strategic business plan, he's out. New director is in. His name is Ben Hart. He formerly worked in the governor's office. And he is shifting the tone a little bit, like you mentioned. He mentioned they're going to put a pause on spending, but I think, you know, we'll watch and see if that actually happens.
Hmm. Well, yeah, the way that it was phrased in your article, it seemed like a pause on sort of big ticket, like or higher dollar spending, and that he was interested in having a kind of evaluation of what money would be spent on, or a new evaluation. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's fair to say. I don't exactly know what he means by that, but I am going to sit down with him one-on-one and interview him next week.
Okay.
So listeners, if you have any questions for the new port director, send them my way and I will try and get those to him.
Ah, fantastic. Leah, great. Thanks for doing that service. How have port opponents like the Stop the Polluting Port Coalition responded to this leadership change and the apparent pause on spending?
You know, I think they still take the position that this port is not needed. It's a waste of public funds. I think they're a little alarmed about all the leadership shakeups that have happened over the years. Like, there've been several boards and restructuring of the board. And now the executive director is out after only having been there for about 3 years. And there's a new one coming in. And I think they're just confused and hope that they're going to be a little more transparent moving forward.
Okay. Leah Larson, we will look to your interview with the new director of the Inland Port Authority. Thank you for reporting on this. Listeners, you can find her reporting at sltrib.com. That's where her email address is as well. And you can tweet to her those questions. George Pyle, I'm going to bring you back into the conversation to allow you to kick off a segment that generally you don't like the name of, the underplayed stories of the week. What's your pick for a story that people ought to pay attention to?
Well, here's in case you missed it, we have a story kind of buried in the e-edition today, but I think a lot of people will be interested in it. The state is trying to pick a new flag, and we have narrowed the many proposed designs down to 20. This is not a good story for radio because you have to look at a picture to know what I'm talking about, yeah. But it's available on sltrib.com and through state websites, and they're running a Survey Monkey form through October 5th, so people can vote for the designs they like. There's beehives, delicate arches, sago lilies, various combinations of things.
Yeah.
Trying to get away from what flag experts and flag lovers call a seal on a bed sheet. Trying to come up with a flag that you can see it from 100 yards away and go, oh, that's the Utah flag, which is something we don't have right now and something that we ought to have.
All right, George Pyle with a pick for the potential or the decision-making process on the new state flag. Check that out at sltrip.com. Leah Larson, your pick for underplayed story.
My pick is a fun story by my colleague Peyton Harkins about boreal toads. And Roger, I don't know if you've ever met a boreal toad, but they're very cute. And they don't do like the ribbit-ribbit, like the croaks that you would think a toad does. They kind of squeak and sound like a puppy. Anyway, they're super cute. And her story is very interesting because they also kind of are indicators of how the environment is doing. And to find out why, I recommend you check out her story.
Awesome. Check that out at sltrip.com. Sort of these are high altitude toads, as I recall from the headline.
Yeah. And cool. Yeah, they seek out wet environments. And so they kind of let us know how, you know, the drought's doing and how our charismatic species are responding.
Great. All right. Check it out at sltrip.com. Peyton Harkins reporting on boreal toads. I, for my part, I'm going to go with Kind of some somber news, the killing of a journalist in neighboring Nevada. And I think that all journalists mourn with mourn for Jeff Gehrman, who was allegedly murdered for simply doing his job over in Las Vegas. An elected official in Las Vegas has been arrested in connection with this killing. He was an official who Gehrman had been reporting on. Anyways, you can find this tragic story, but really interesting and compelling reporting, both of his and of his colleagues now reporting on his death, at the outlet that he worked for, the Las Vegas Journal Review. And since we have just a little tiny bit more time, I think I'll also mention the fact that this past week I have had COVID, and not trying to elicit sympathy or anything, but it has been brutal, and I'm vaccinated and boosted, but disease hits people in different ways. I had let my guard down, like so many other people, and I think it's worth just mentioning the fact that COVID is still out there and still having a pretty serious impact. With that, I will say to both George Pyle, editorial page editor, and Leah Larson, water and land use reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining me on the show today.
Thanks. Feel better.
Thank you. Feel better, Rush.
I will try. And with that, our show comes to a close. This is Behind the Headlines, a co-production of the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, which is heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. You can find podcasts of this particular episode and all of our past programs, that is, over at kcpw.org or through your podcast app. I'm Roger McDonough. Really appreciate your tuning in. Come back again soon.